There is this thing. Do you realize do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, April the 8th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
First, some news. Mask wearing will no longer be mandatory in many public places, including schools, starting this Saturday, May 14th. The province will still require a mask in healthcare facilities where vulnerable populations are at risk of exposure, and public transit where social distancing is difficult to maintain. And Quebec Premier François Legault called on Trudeau to close the unofficial border crossing at Roxham Road, south of Montreal. Legault says that the province lacks the capacity to accommodate asylum seekers. Trudeau says that, quote, we can have an enormous border and we're not going to start arming or putting fences on it, end quote. And Premier Legault also turned down an invitation to participate in Quebec's second ever televised English language debate with provincial party leaders. The first was held in 2018. This year's debate is set for September 20th before the October 3rd general election. And three grade 1 students were sent to a Montreal area hospital after eating candy allegedly laced with cannabis, which they found on the floor of their school bus. The students attend Franklin Hill Elementary School in Repentigny. Edibles are legal in Quebec, but not in the form of candy, in case children mistakenly eat them. And the Cree Nation Bears, an all-Cree team, made their first appearance at the Quebec International Pee Wee Hockey Tournament and won their first game yesterday. This tournament is one of the largest minor hockey competitions and has taken place in Quebec City until May 15th. Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Brian Jefferson, and up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we'll be sharing the air with Indigenous Action Podcast. We'll tune into a conversation between host Bon and Indigiqueers Simona Bear Club, Blue, and Demian Dinizeye. They'll discuss cis heteronormative narratives around missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, Two-Spirit, and trans people. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use.
Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied North America.
This is an autonomous, anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, channelzero.com.
Oka, hello everybody. So happy to be on the mic today for our Queering MMIW G2ST show. So before we get started, we're actually going to give y'all an update on what's happening out there in the front lines. So we got a submission from Libres Las Tres, and they're working on a campaign to free the political prisoners Carla, Magda, and Arlie, and they are unjustly detained right now in Mexico City for during the eviction of the Cuba refuge squat. So they were campaigning against femicide, the femicide that happened in, you know, well, really all across the globe, but particularly in what's happening, you know, in so-called Mexico. So that leads pretty well into our conversation today about MMIW G2ST. So the government there is repressing and silencing social workers and activists who are fighting against femicide and working really closely with families. You can follow what they're up to and give that support to them on their Instagram. And their Instagram handle is at Libres Las and then a 3. So that's LIBRESLAS3. Okay. So like we said, today's show topic is going to be on MMIW G2ST, and that stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, Two-Spirit, and Trans Folks. So every Indigenous person that I've ever met has been impacted by this movement, and in conversations around the critical analysis of what's going on in this movement, there is a hyper focus and of cis women in this movement. And there have been attempts made to include our queer relatives, hence, you know, the addition of the two-spirit and trans abbreviations in the hashtag. And of course, that was an attempt to raise awareness and include us queers in the movement. But as we've seen, the cisnormativity still dominates the narratives around the issue. And so with me today, we have Demian, Simona, and Blue to talk about this issue, as well as, you know, give some experiences and some analysis about why it is that cis heteronormativity and cis heteropatriarchal violence influences the erasure of queers in this movement. So if you all want to give a brief introduction as well as provide your pronouns, then we can go ahead and get started in our conversation.
Dos hinana'ina, jinatat niyehi na'asitna. Hello, I wanted to greet myself in my native tongue. My name is Bluebird, and I am Northern Arapaho. I'm a two-spirited individual, and my pronouns, I mean, I don't really have a preference, so she, he, they are all fine.
Hello, I'm Simona Berka. My people are the Nakota, Dakota, and Mono Red Bottom Clan, and my pronouns are she, her, they, them.
Yat'e, my name is Demian Dinet Yashe. I am a late 30s non-binary queer person. Hair is, I guess, just above my nipple. I'm wearing a black shirt. I have dark brown hair. I'm wearing a backwards baseball cap. I have on some red earrings that were made by an Indigenous artist up in Canada. I'm sitting in the hotel room, currently coming to you from Lenape Hoking, more commonly referred to the specific area of Brooklyn, New York. I am from the Diné tribe with some Zuni ancestry. And my clans are Nastaje, Tabahe, and Tortachitni. And I live in Portland, Oregon, which is the ancestral homelands to various Indigenous tribes, but was also, like most Indigenous homelands, you know, very rich trading grounds between various Indigenous tribes.
And of course, my name is Bon, and my pronouns are they, them. I'm going to follow Demian's lead and give y'all a verbal description of what I look like and where I am. Well, I'm a Cocoa Paw and German, so I identify as Native and white. And I'm sitting in my office right now. There's some plants behind me, as well as a bookshelf with some of my favorite manga. And I have long, black, wavy hair, and of course my Cocoa Paw bangs. That's to protect us from the sun, our little foreheads from getting burned. I have several tattoos on my arms. I have my septum pierced, and there is a black nose ring in it. And my pronouns are they, them. So actually, Blue and Simona, why don't you all give a verbal description of what's happened on video there for folks who may have different seeing abilities.
I just want to acknowledge that that was amazing. Thank you. I'm going to definitely include that more often in anything I do. Thank you for that. Behind me, well, there's a lot of paintings. My favorite is the drum, the little one's drum with the bear print on it. Afro-Indigenous curly hair, dentilium, big anti-energy earrings. And necklace, sitting on a couch.
I am currently in transit back to the Wind River Reservation where I reside with my tribe and also the Eastern Shoshone relatives. I'm currently on my homelands in Colorado, and so that feels really good to like anchor into my womb space and have this conversation. And yeah, I'm here in a black and white bandana top. It's like my second time wearing it, but feeling good about it. And this, wearing this sacred, beautiful necklace made out of seeds from the Amazon. And it was gifted to me by a good relative who I pray with. And I'm wearing some very beautiful, like, abalone circle star, you know, like, dark and light blue and white earrings that my sibling had got for me for my birthday with some dentilion on the bottom. And I'm rocking that, like, 6 months after morning haircut, you know? It was up to, like, my ears, and it's grown about a good 6 inches in the last 6 months, so...
Nice.
I got also got some plants with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I gotta have those more than human relatives with us.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, awesome. I just feel like I am in a queer heaven today where I get to be with these amazing people and talk about an issue that I really, really, really care about and we all really, really care about. So to begin, I guess I wanted to just provide, you know, a brief background in history into the conversation around MMIWG2ST, because it's an issue that I think has garnered a lot of attention in recent years, but people really need to know that, you know, rape and murder have always been used as mechanisms of control by colonizers, settlers, and now, unfortunately, you know, our assimilated kin, or I don't even, maybe we can get into that later, but essentially we were, you know, folks were violently forced into submission by European contact, and that has really led to the diminishment of our autonomy and the sovereignty of our lands. And so, you know, this is something that we've been talking about in our kitchens, in our communities, and with our relatives for a long, long time. And as we started to mobilize around the issue on a larger scale in those grassroots efforts to combat this horrifying violence, the movement, you know, like I said, in the last several decades has garnered more and more attention. And because of that, you know, the nonprofit industrial complex has saw an opportunity to co-opt our grassroots efforts and movements and kind of monetize this violence that we experience. And then, of course, there are other governmental entities that have coerced, you know, people who started out on those grassroots efforts into their control to maintain control of our autonomy. And so within that specifically, and during this conversation, we really want to focus on how queers experience erasure within the movement, and how rape culture perpetuates our struggles, and really what that co-optation of our movement by the NPIC, which is the nonprofit industrial complex, has done to the movement and our communities and our relatives. I think before we begin, it would be helpful to maybe define some basic terms. So I think that maybe one that people hear and maybe kind of have an idea about, but I think hearing, you know, from us what we think cisnormativity is would be really helpful. So is there anybody who would want to define that for our listeners? And even in the context of the struggle that we're talking about today?
I can take a crack at it. So the term cisgendered is a term that refers to people who identify with the colonial gender that they were assigned at birth. So a cis female and cis male, you know, they, you know, were assigned male or female at birth, and throughout their entire lives, they've chosen to remain identified as such. Within that, you know, I think there's a larger breakdown of how cis sexuality, like, functions that oftentimes doesn't get talked about. And at least, you know, outside of Indigenous communities or trans, non-binary communities, queer communities as well, is how gender is a colonial construct. And, you know, science as well, you know, plays into that, especially when it comes to gender assignment. And so that's kind of how I like to, you know, kind of think about it. That's how I like to also become critical of it. Cisnormativity then applies to the ways that normative culture prefers cisgendered individuals. And so, like the term, you know, heteronormativity, which applies to, you know, heterosexual communities who have a preference as well in mainstream Western society, cisgendered individuals, as we see, you know, have a stronger preference. There is a larger wealth of access and privileges that are afforded to cisgendered individuals. Oftentimes, you know, they are still working underneath the constructs and oppression of heteropatriarchy. And so, you know, it's obviously a very complex issue, but it becomes violent and harmful when we're, you know, when non-binary, trans, two-spirit individuals are, you know, facing harassment, death, violence, and presently, you know, overwhelming and disgusting amount of colonial legislation against our bodies and livelihood. But that's, you know, I think, you know, with taking all that into consideration, it entirely has ties to the issue at hand. You know, within the larger colonial construct as well, some of the first people who were assaulted, violated, and murdered were our, what would presently be known as, you know, trans, non-binary individuals. by early colonizers. And if anyone wants to add on top of that, feel free.
I think that's a pretty good definition to start. And I think in answering, some of the prompts that we have today, we can further elaborate. And then I think within that, and giving a basic definition of what rape culture is inherently tied to cisnormativity and, the patriarchy. So rape culture is basically, just very briefly, the dominant society's normalization of violence, in particular against, women and queer folks. And it basically, people who perpetuate rape culture essentially sign on to that that narrative that people are available for entitlement, and it's because of cisnormativity, rape culture says that we're like socialized to we're like totally desensitized towards the violences that we're talking about today. And I think there is a very specific way in which that influences being a queer person and that normalization of violence as well. And so I think, again, throughout our conversation, I think it'll become clear as to what we're talking about, especially later on when I give some of the submissions for the call outs that we received for the podcast today. And then another thing that we could just briefly define is co-optation. So what does that mean?
When an organization or a group takes on like the work that's being done and says that they're doing the work, but like essentially is like capitalizing off of it and exploiting the like grassroots vision of the work, or at least like that's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that lends in really nicely to the next thing. Just to give a quick brief definition of the nonprofit industrial complex. That's a really, I don't know how that could really be briefly defined, but if anyone wants to try, it might be helpful just for folks to have that foundation before we start getting really into our claws out analysis.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty similar to what I just communicated, but like on a more global scale or like a huger scale, where these organizations are basically like funneling in all of this money to support this thing. And so people think that like this work is being done. Meanwhile, they are in a way supporting the thing that they say they're not, like, or that they're like working against, in a short explanation.
Yeah.
I kind of see it as the theft and censoring of our knowledge, of our wisdom, of our history, and used for their own personal gain agenda.
Yeah, another thing it does is it totally strips, our movements from the autonomy of being tied to any colonial entity, right? Because nonprofits, by and large, get their funding from the government through grants. And even if they are private grants, they're still tied to someone else's agenda. And so it kind of has this, this effect on grassroots movements that takes away what it is that we're doing on the ground and kind of almost legalizes it in a way. And we know that the legal system was created and upholds colonial mechanisms of oppression and violence against, you know, particularly Black and Indigenous folks. So with that, I'm super excited to get into the conversation. I hope that kind of orientation with some of those words, based on feedback from podcast listeners, like helps to kind of follow along our conversations. So thank you to those who provided that feedback, that it would be helpful to kind of give some of those definitions from our perspective, as opposed to, you know, whatever comes up on Urban Dictionary or Google or what have you. So I think maybe a good place to start for folks is kind of like, you know, why we're even here in the first place. I think all of us in some way has probably experienced what it feels like to just live in a cis normative society, but then also what happens when, you know, our movements, our Indigenous struggles, then perpetuate that erasure of a queer identity. And like we said before, the general movement, which is typically just, you know, considered the MMIW movement, so Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Movement, you know, they've made some small and subtle gestures to include us, but I'm wondering, in y'all's experience, how have queers experienced erasure, and what has that looked like?
For me, and something that like I've experienced personally, by leaders in my community who, are actively leading, you know, the MMIW movement. They speak and use only statistics and experiences based on the woman's identity, while queer and trans and two-spirit relatives are not being like monitored, included, or thought about at all. And then in the cases where some of our relatives are being misgendered when they're trying to be located, also when they're like finding justice for them, and it doesn't like tell the full narrative of what's happening through the queer lens.
Mm-hmm. And that ties in really well with, you know, what happens when our movements are co-opted by the nonprofit industrial complex, because it really is dehumanizing to everybody who, you know, is part of those statistics. But then it's even more so when, you know, a person who is of a non-binary identity just gets shoved into one of those categories of being a man or a woman. And so we can also thank the MPIC for that.
What I've experienced in some of those spaces is when I, you know, I call out some of the behavior, some of the problematic things being said, and it's like, oh, you're queer. And it's an immediate sexualization because I'm femme presenting, and it's an immediate, like, it's a turn on. It's just, you have to battle that too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One way that I think another space that's important to talk about is social media and its influence on MMIW and Indigenous communities and Indigenous identities, you know, because I have for the last few years facilitated a group called RISE, which stands for Radical Indigenous Survivance and Empowerment, and we have a Instagram at RISE Indigenous. And so, you know, oftentimes we'll focus on Indigenous queer, trans, non-binary, and two-spirit communities. We also had like a very large like Indigenous feminist and matriarchal sort of support system as well. But, you know, once we started to embrace more of embrace, amplify, and empower, you know, Indigenous, queer, trans, non-binary, and two-spirit communities, then we started to, like, get more opposition from other Indigenous tribes. And it's usually Indigenous, cis, heterosexual men who will chime in and say, this is, y'all are crazy, like, you know, in like Indigenous gender, transgender identities and non-binary or gender variant identities did not exist prior to colonization. Like, there's no actual proof of that. Like, what are you talking about? That's, you know, that, that didn't exist. And so it completely just disregards the fact that, you know, there are many Indigenous tribes that have various gender systems and sexual identities that are even, like, for the Diné people, because I'm, you know, I can speak on behalf of the Diné people, you know, there, it's written, like, into our creation stories. And so the ways that gender has been constructed is ancestral, you know, it has been going on that way for centuries prior to colonization. So that's one way that, you know, our identities are being erased through social media. But, you know, there was a time back a few years ago when I wouldn't say that we were the only Indigenous, subversive Indigenous, like, space that existed on social media. But it was interesting to see the ways that some of these larger Indigenous accounts that are, you know, presently taking up a lot of space, the ways that initially they were not inclusive of Indigenous, queer, trans, or non-binary people. It wasn't until a lot of the people were being called out and that, you know, a lot of this support started to take place and started to happen. So you see some, like, inclusion happening out there, but I also, like, question, you know, the overall investment that these spaces have with Indigenous, queer, trans, non-binary communities. I think for a lot of people's, like, it's very trending. It's very trendy. And so in order for them to survive as a space, in order for them to maintain the power that they have through social capital, it becomes their best, in their best interest to take on a lot of the issues that are happening within our communities. But again, this is where something like co-optation and appropriation also comes into play. Because through that, they're also inherently co-opting and appropriating a lot of our issues in order to give themselves, in order to enhance their social capital, in order to move them up the ladder. But again, a lot of these spaces are not run by Indigenous, queer, trans, or non-binary individuals. A lot of these spaces are not run by queer individuals. So I think that's, you know, that's something that is, in the present space that we live in, through having to deal with, like, simulated alternative realities that exist within, like, colonial apps and social media spaces, that's another place that you know, that's another place where the battlefield or the battleground is, like, confusing, because you see a lot of these things being posted creating awareness about, like, two-spirited peoples, but it's still questionable to a certain degree.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the social media element, because that is primarily the place in which this particular struggle has any platform. And last year, I remember a bunch of, you know, kin and relative had posted something on May 5th to highlight and raise awareness about MMIWG2ST, and they were all censored. I don't know if anyone else remembers that happening. Yeah, I see heads nodding. And that's a really, you know, I think pertinent and relevant point to bring up, because not only, you know, since the struggle is already, you know, dominated by particularly like cis-centric narratives, it further creates, you know, conflict for conflict and erasure for queers, because if cis people can't even get the platform and, you know, the traction for a movement, then where, you know, where does that really leave us in the conversations? And in some ways, I think there's such a huge desensitization of the experience of being like a queer person, that it's just even more, you know, it's even more violent to censor our movements. And through, you know, these platforms are just basically colonialism perpetuating itself, right? And so I think that with that being said, you know, one thing that I think would be good to talk about too is how specifically cisnormativity and rape culture influence the experience of being queer and at risk for being murdered or going missing. So I think that ties into, you know, some of what we offered earlier in the conversation about what cisnormativity and rape culture are. But I'm curious to help listeners understand what the intersectionality of being both Indigenous and queer means for us and you know, both the struggle of just living our everyday lives and then also being a queer person who, you know, walks about the earth, the planet, the lands, knowing that we're at such a higher risk for experiencing these specific types of violences.
Yeah, I mean, I could, you know, I think, especially with a lot of the legislation that is being posed, you know, I start to think about being young, growing up in a border town. I grew up in Gallup, New Mexico. You know, sexuality in the 90s was like, scary as fuck, especially we were in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. You know, I was fearful that even just like identifying as a queer person back then would just inherently expose me to this, not through any even like sexual or human contact. But that's the way it felt. You know, it felt that even if you identified as this, you were just, it was just assumed that you were dirty, you were defiled, there was no respect whatsoever for queer people. And it still feels that way today. I was, you know, fortunately enough, I had like, you know, queer community in Gallup. I found, you know, like-minded individuals, friends who, you know, I still haven't talked to, who are also queer, who are also Native. You know, we all, for the most part, escaped and like fled Gallup, got out as quickly as we could, but not everyone survives that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where cisnormativity comes into play, is, you know, the forms of like violence, harassment, ridicule, belittling that we come into contact with on a daily basis is meant to create situations that question our survival, whether or not we want to survive. It leads to youth suicides. It leads to high rates of self-harm. So I think a lot of this legislation is actually meant to carry on these colonial traditions, but to do so in a way where through our own self-colonization, through our own self-hate that is like taught to us and indoctrinated into us, that we actually become the ones who carry on the missions of the empire. And it's amazing that any of us survive, but that's where this like hardcore resilience comes into play. Anyway, I hope that's helpful to a certain degree.
Yeah, just to piggyback off of that a little bit and recognize like that there's so much shame, instilled in us and just like our sexuality in general, apart from it being so like who you like, but like the fact that like it's a conversation at all. Just like previous to colonization, you know, each relative played a role that supported themselves and their community regardless of their gender. And so when the missionaries came in and separated the families, they also separated us based on which body parts we had. And so all the boys' hair was cut the same and the girls had a slighter, longer haircut, like signifying the difference between us, you know. The boys had to wear pants and blazers and the girls had to wear blouses and dresses. And on top of all of that, we're actively being fetishized, molested, and silenced. And so like these traumas are carried on into each of our communities and families that are affected by the boarding schools. And so like, yeah, these are things that like we as queer people have to deal with like on a daily basis, like from our families, from through our communities, and just like all of the trauma that our people have experienced. It's like we've become dominated by the white man ideology, where like, yeah, the lines, the gender lines and roles and stereotypes are like really strong. And so when survivors tell our stories, we're met with like a bunch of really insensitive questions. And it feels mm-hmm. like our truths aren't being heard or understood, like, and held in the way that they need to be. Like you said, you know, Indigenous people are fetishized in general, and queer and trans and two-spirited people are targeted because the society has hypersexualized us through media, and not just like social media, but like porn sites and different like, you know, fantasy fetishization stories and movies and things. So yeah, just wanted to communicate that as well.
And I do want to piggyback on that too. Like, my spirit's very masculine at times, and I'm very much a confrontational person. So when I, as a survivor, when I came forward with my story, one of the main things that I heard from some folk was, we have a hard time believing you because you would have stabbed this person. You would have done this. You would have done that. That they expected me to somehow not go to default freeze, but to go to fight. And since I didn't do that, that made my call out, you know, not legitimate to them. So I struggle with that too, like really trying to be more feminine. It's why I'm more femme presenting, to kind of counter how, you know, the other parts of me. And sucks.
Yeah, it really does. And honestly, like I feel you in that because I'm like the opposite. And, like I was so like sexualized as a young person, and I was like really femme presenting. And after, you know, I mean, yeah, not to get too deep into things, I felt more comfortable presenting myself in like baggier clothing and like more like malpresenting just to protect myself in a way. And yeah, I don't know, it definitely also like gets to me sometimes when like I want to like just dress up and like feel good, but also like wondering like, yeah, I don't know, just like the constructs and like the things in the mind that like prevent us from being able to like fully express who we are as individuals apart from like these gender norms.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that brings up a really interesting point. You know, I think in my navigation of what my gender is, which is that I don't have one, I tried out, I think every burgeoning queer has probably gone through this, but I tried the, you know, androgynous, like tomboy, quote unquote, presentation. And even that did not protect me from, you know, the catcalling, the stares, the sexualization, and, you know, the experience of living in a society where rape culture is the dominant mentality. And so I think that within, you know, our conversations about that, it's so important to bring up how, you know, a lot of us queers are fluid in how we want to present our spirit and present physically. And that still is not a protection towards the risk of, you know, experiencing what would lead us to go missing or be murdered. And so that's something that we really need to deconstruct on a societal level, is this gendering of presentation, you know, clothing, our spirits even. And so I think that ties in, you know, again, with the concept of living in a cisnormative society where we might see someone who, you know, looks feminine and then automatically assume it's a woman. And that's something that I think we really need to just abolish from our mentalities, because, of course, the unfortunate reality is that for every, you know, we are all impacted by the biases of the colonial institutions of gender and everything, really. And so, you know, being, you know, having that experience of continuing to be harassed and targeted because of how I looked and that I presented, you know, more queer, I guess, if you will, did not necessarily, you know, lead to anything changing. If anything, it made, you know, it felt like I was even more like out there in the open. And then I had this really beautiful experience of, you know, realizing that, what and how I appear, actually has nothing to do with my gender, which is when I realized I didn't have one in the first place. And so that's actually when I, in my entire life and currently so am, you know, presenting the most feminine, that I ever have in my life, because that's what I like. And so, you know, regardless of what I look like, we live in a rape culture. And so it's like there's a target on us every time we step out of our homes. And so why not just, you know, look however the hell I want to? Because I know that my spirit is not, you know, related to any kind of physical presentation that I could possibly manage to present in this world. And so I think that in some ways, you know, kind of looking outside of, you know, our, like, looking outside of the boxes that gender has been put into, and then seeing how, you know, now that I kind of do fit into that cis assumed woman identity, how as a queer, that actually make things really complicated, and creates, not conflict within me and my spirit, but conflict within, the perceptions of other people. And it's very confusing for folks, because they don't understand why a non-binary person would become even more feminine, I guess, than they ever had been before. And so those are all things that lead to, I think, one, you know, potentially making choices that put them in situations where, you know, whether, you know, a young queer might be running away from their community, or, you know, all these various, like, things that happen when we live in a world that doesn't see us as valid people. That dehumanizes us. So those are all definitely things that, you know, cisnormativity and rape culture has contributed to, I think, the circumstances in which a queer person would go missing or be murdered. Absolutely. And then I think another, you know, important element to this conversation too has a lot to do with the carceral system, because you know, in looking at the NPIC's you know, approach to this struggle, it really is it's really clear that you know, the people who are leading these nonprofits in the struggle are really, like, kind of obsessed with laws, and they really believe that, you know, there are good laws and there are bad laws, and those bad and outdated laws are the reasons why, you know, this struggle exists. And there is a complete erasure of the root of the violence, which is the long legacy of colonial oppression of, you know, Black and Indigenous people, and specifically Black and Indigenous queer people. And so when we look at that co-optation of our movement by the NPIC, there's an even further erasure of queers, and then a further maintenance of cisnormativity. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about earlier about how the NPIC is very data-driven. And I think it's important to mention that, to me, I think data is essentially a colonial extraction of our experiences of being alive. And I think within that, you know, we have this attempt at looking at how we can make things, how we can, like, live in a more liberated society, free from the free from the idea of being murdered or going missing. But then we have all of these resources just, like, you know, getting funneled into these nonprofits that then perpetuate exactly what we've been trying to fight against. And so I think that it's really important for people to understand that there is no law or policy that I think will ever address the root of colonial oppression and violence. And so I'd love to hear what y'all think about that, and how, like, how you've seen, you know, nonprofits and the MPIC actually kind of undermine the work that we've done to address the MMIWG2ST struggle.
Well, with what you said with data, I mean, that was just like the main thing. There was no database. And then also when we do sometimes add the intersectionality of being Indigenous to the issues that they're, you know, addressing, it's always, well, remember that one, something else? I mean, it's like they never really have a place for us, or at least that's how I feel. When I was working in the academic realm or nonprofit realms, it was like we always seemed to get pushed aside. Our issues were on the back burner, or if I bring up missing or murdered Indigenous relatives, it would be, well, this person disappeared, that person, and they would always be non-Indigenous, and they would change the topic to something else besides, you know, the issue that I brought to the table.
Mm-hmm. I also feel like while they tried to include us in the narrative by, like, adding the extra letters and numbers and things, you know, it's very similar to, like, the LGBTQIA2S, and it's a little just insensitive because in a way they're still like putting us in a separate group from the woman when we are still a part of that narrative in a way. It's like the feminine energy of things or whatever. And yeah, like also feeling like the nonprofits essentially become a huge part of the problem by ignoring the issues like the violence to the land, the drug and alcohol addiction, the intergenerational trauma. Like, these are things that they don't want to talk about because they're actively engaged in these things. And they believe that...
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an episode from May 5th, 2022, created by the Indigenous Action Podcast. If you want to hear the rest of the show, you can head to channelzeronetwork.com. And before we go, here's some news that you can use. Protesters, including members of the Kanawagi community, are marching against Provincial Bill 96 in Montreal this Saturday. The proposed law would make Quebec's French language charter a top priority. Members of the National Assembly are expected to vote on the Bill 96 this month. Protesters will meet at 10 a.m. in front of Dawson College and march in front of the Premier François Legault's office. And the youth organization Apathy is Boring is looking for a cookbook contributors aged 18 to 30. The book will spotlight cultural traditions and explore how recipes can serve as stories of resilience among BIPOC communities. Chosen contributors will receive an honorarium. The deadline is May 15th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, search for Resilience Cooks on Facebook. And Canadians can see a total lunar eclipse on Sunday evening if skies are clear. This means the moon will pass through Earth's shadow, the first time for Canadians since last May. For Montrealers, the partial eclipse will start around 10:30 p.m., with the maximum eclipse at 12:11 a.m. Plateau Astro will offer free telescope viewings at the north end of Parc Jean-Mons. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Tess Pilkington, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, Killian Davenport-Brown, Elsie Yang, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook, search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on 90.3 FM.
CKUT Radio, Community Radio, CKUT.CAO, CKUT, 90.3 FM, Montreal.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à votre émission d'art et culture préférée Café à CKUT 93. Ce soir, je suis accompagné de Marie-Pierre. Ça va, Marie?
Allô, ça va?
On va être les deux. On va jaser première partie littérature, deuxième partie théâtre. Donc, littérature, ça va être Nature morte au couteau de Anne-Marie Desmeules et tout est tori